My name is Louisa Fitzgerald. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Lowy Institute. Since 2015, the Institute and the NGV have partnered to run a series of events about the world, and we see, obviously, such an appetite for analysis of what's happening in the world in Melbourne that it's an easy decision to bring our prominent guests here. Lowy Institute at the NGV events feature leading international and Australian experts. And right here in this room, we've hosted events with James Fallows of The Atlantic, Hu Shu Lee of Caixin Media, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Tonight, we are absolutely delighted to add Thomas Wright to that list. Tom is going to speak about what the Trump administration means for Asia. And with developments in Asia and the world in the past week, there's no better time for that discussion. Firstly, Foreign Minister Julie Bishop's lecture in Singapore last week, at which she argued that Asia is in a strategic holding pattern and that Asian capitals are waiting to see what kind of role the United States will play in Asia. She also called for the United States to play an even greater role as the indispensable strategic power in the Indo-Pacific. And the second development is the meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, which will be held at the weekend White House Mar-a-Lago in April. Fareed Zakaria wrote in the Washington Post this week that after 75 years of US leadership on the world stage, the Mar-a-Lago summit might mark the beginning of a handover of power from the United States to China. So understanding the Trump administration's stance on Asia policy is one of the biggest questions in foreign policy right now. Ladies and gentlemen, joining us today is an analyst who took a deep dive into Mr. Trump's worldview while most people were convinced Mr. Trump's next job would be as CEO of Trump TV. Tom holds degrees from University College Dublin, Cambridge, and Georgetown. He has worked as a senior researcher at Princeton, as a lecturer at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and later as Executive Director of Studies at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Tom is currently Director of the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution. His writing has featured in the Financial Times, International Herald Tribune, and the Washington Post. He's also the author of an excellent Lowy Institute paper, The 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Crisis of US Foreign Policy, published in October last year. And he recently wrote an essay for Politico on Mr. Trump's foreign policy, which I highly recommend. Tom is ahead of the curve when it comes to analysing Mr. Trump's foreign policy, and what he says is of real importance to Asia and indeed to Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tom Wright.
Louisa, thank you for that great introduction, and thank you to the Lowy Institute for inviting me here to Australia. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm glad to start off the week in the best city of all, in Melbourne. I had a lovely weekend here, terrific weather, and it's a great pleasure to be here today. What I'd like to talk to, and I'd like to thank NGV too for hosting us this evening. My main message, I guess, is that the Trump administration isn't as good as it looks. There's sort of reason to be concerned, but I'll get to that a little bit later. Let me just start by going back a little bit in history. In 1984, a Washington Post journalist named Louis Romano wrote a profile of an up-and-coming New York real estate tycoon. Donald Trump was then just 38 years old, and he'd already made his mark in New York. Romano, in the profile, mentions the buildings, she mentions the brash personality, the self-promotion, and a really strange obsession he had with securing good tables at restaurants. It's something he talked about a lot in the profile. But then she reveals in the profile that Trump requested the interview to talk about something else entirely. She writes, "This morning, Trump has a new idea. He wants to talk about the threat of nuclear war. He wants to talk about how the United States should negotiate with the Soviets. He wants to be the negotiator." "Some people have an ability to negotiate," Trump said. "It's an art you're basically born with. You either have it or you don't." And she asked him, "Well, what do you know about the Soviet Union and arms control?" And the 38-year-old Trump said, he said he could learn about missiles quickly. "It would take an hour and a half to learn everything there is to know about missiles. I think I know most of it anyway. You're just talking about getting updated on a situation." And then Romano says, well, what would you do? What's your strategy? What's your strategy with the Soviets? And he said, I have a strategy. I know exactly what to do with the Soviet Union in these nuclear arms negotiations. But I can't tell you. It's a secret because I don't want to tip my hand unless I have to actually negotiate with them. I get into a position of authority. It's a secret plan to end the nuclear arms race, quite like the secret plan to defeat ISIS. Ladies and gentlemen, Donald Trump has been on every side of many issues. And there are many things that he doesn't know very much about. I mean, that much is clear from the campaign. But one of my main sort of messages this evening is that this president has been interested in talking and focused and even writing on U.S. foreign policy for 35 years. He has not come new to this issue. There is a track record of which the Washington Post profile is one of the early snippets that gives some indication to his worldview and to the type of president and that he wants to be. So what I'd like to do in the next 30 minutes or so is talk to you about two things. The first is what that worldview is and what it means for the Trump administration's foreign policy. And the second is to try to apply that to Asia and look at what it is that he actually intends to do in this region, what his administration intends to do. And they're not always the same thing, as we'll find out. His worldview and his administration's foreign policy are not the same. And then to finish by saying, what does this mean for Australia and for America's allies in the region? How should you all respond to Trump's America? Should it mean that there should be a change in foreign policy for Australia, Japan, South Korea, and others? So let me begin by taking a look back over that 30-year period. The earliest record we have of Donald Trump talking about foreign policy is in 1980, just before the Reagan administration, the tail end of the Carter administration. And unsurprisingly, he talks about the U.S. not being respected, this time by Iran, which, with the hostage crisis at the time, was pretty common in terms of people saying that. We do see a little snippet of him talking about the U.S. needing to think about taking Iranian oil, and that maybe the U.S. should show Iran who's boss by intervening militarily. But he really comes back and talks about foreign policy more in the mid-1980s. And I think there are three things that really drive him during this period, all of which I think will be familiar to all of you today who've taken an interest in the campaign and in his presidency in the early years. The first thing that he believes and really drives him is a hostility or skepticism of America's military alliances. This is sort of a feature of his various comments throughout the 80s. In 1987, he published a now famous letter in the New York Times, Boston Globe, and Washington Post. He spent $95,000 of his own money to buy a full-page ad in those three newspapers. And he was 41 years old at the time. That's sort of an unusual thing. Only Mark Zuckerberg does that now. Not many people who are 41 real estate developers or business people publish open letters to the American people about foreign and defense policy. And this letter was titled, "There's Nothing Wrong with American Foreign and Defense Policy That a Little Backbone Can't Cure." And the first line was, "Japan and other nations are taking advantage of the United States." He goes on to say that the U.S. is defending countries for free that would be wiped off the face of the earth if it wasn't for U.S. security protection, and that they should be paying the United States, directly compensating the United States for these alliances. He says the U.S. has been laughed at because it's not doing this, and that the U.S. is in decline and in trouble as a result. He doesn't use the words "make America great again" or "America first," but he comes pretty close. And this is at the tail end of the Reagan administration, not sort of the typical administration that Republicans tend to think as America in decline or America on the way out. He proceeds in interviews afterwards, and he's actually thinking about running for president at this stage. He's thinking about running for president in 1988. He mentions to George H.W. Bush's campaign manager that maybe he will be a good addition to the Bush ticket in 1988 as vice president. So he has an interest in politics at this stage. And throughout the next 20 years, really, or 18 years or so, alliances and how America has been taken advantage of because it provides security for other countries is a common theme. He says to the Washington Post during the campaign that he doesn't really believe the United States should be in Asia or Europe unless there's a real benefit in being there financially. He calls NATO obsolete and said that it really has no traditional role and that Europeans ought to defend themselves. So that's the first, I think, core sort of visceral belief that Donald Trump has, and it really is how he looks at the world. We saw a little inkling of this the other day in his press conference with Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany when he said, when he said, well, you owe us a lot of money and you haven't paid your dues to NATO and you need to pay us for that. Of course, NATO has no dues and there is no money that goes to the United States from NATO. The US does spend a lot on defense. It spends about 71%, I think, of the overall defense expenditure of NATO. But actually, the US contribution to NATO operating costs are 19 or 21%, I think. It's about 20%. And the rest is covered by the other NATO member states. So it's a little more even than he suggests. But that's sort of the first view. The second sort of core belief he has is he does have a hostility to free trade. He thinks that the US has been ripped off on free trade deals with other countries. In the campaign and now, he says he's not against free trade. He's just in favor of fair trade. And a lot of people would agree with that. That's a pretty common view. But the truth is that he's opposed every trade deal the US has signed since World War II. And in an interview with the New York Times, he was asked, well, what president do you admire? What president do you like? And he said, you know, most Republicans say Reagan, but I can't say Reagan because I disagree with him in trade. He said, in fact, I've disagreed with every American president on trade since the war. He said, I think you'd need to go back to the 19th century to find a president I really agreed with on trade. And so that's pretty interesting. You know, that's the comment of somebody who has thought about it at least a little bit, has some sense of their place in American history, who hasn't just sort of made it up on the spot. If he made it up on the spot, he'd just probably say Reagan was a saint. He's a terrific guy. That's what Republican candidates often say. In his joint address to the Houses of Congress a few weeks ago, he actually went back to Abraham Lincoln and called Abraham Lincoln a protectionist and said that the US had to examine the example of Lincoln on economic policy. And he had some quote from Lincoln on protectionism. So Trump, I think, is at heart a mercantilist. He believes that the US should negotiate sort of bilateral deals that are sort of tilted in America's favor, focused on manufacturing, and really try to become self-sufficient in the global economy. And this is a view that he's had really going back to the rise of Japan as an economic power in the 1980s. And so if you remember, Japan was sort of meant to be, you know, the next great superpower. Most of the, you know, Hollywood movies at the time, you know, sort of focused on Japan as a rising power. China will come way later. And so that's sort of where it started from him. But it changed over time to China. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. The third sort of thing he really believes is he is pretty supportive of authoritarianism and of strong men. He does have a fondness for Russia. He sort of had a first visit at the Soviet Union in 1986. He's visited several times, four or five times, I think, since then, most recently in 2013, I think, with the Miss Universe contest. And, you know, there are many conspiracy theories about this, and we've all heard them. But I think that they're a little unhelpful because there's no evidence of those. And so I prefer to look at, like, what's the rational explanation? How might he think about it? And I think when you look at Trump, his sort of view of security is almost entirely economic, right? He worries mainly about economic threats from other countries. And so he's concerned about countries that the US has an economic relationship with. And he usually thinks that the country that has an economic relationship with the US is exploiting it. There's a couple of exceptions. Australia is actually one. I can't find anything bad he said about Australia, except for that phone call, which we'll come to in a few minutes. But I think you're in good shape relative to others in his mind. But he views it economically. And of course, there's no real economic relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union or the United States and Russia. They're sort of two separate entities. They don't trade very much with each other. There's not much economic interdependence. So I think as he looks at it, there's no real problem. And then he doesn't really care about NATO that much, so he's not too worried about that. And in terms of the threats he sees today, he sees threats from China's economic rise. and from, you know, what he called radical Islam, and he sees Russia as an ally against both of those. And I think he also sort of admires Putin because he likes sort of strong men and authoritarian leaders. In 1990, he gave an interview to Playboy magazine, of all places, and he actually was asked, he had just come back from Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time, and he said he was disillusioned with Gorbachev. He felt Gorbachev had lost control. And the interviewer said, you know, do you think that Gorbachev should have been more like the Chinese at Tiananmen Square? And he said, yes, exactly. He said, that was messy, but they were strong. They showed they were strong. And that's what matters. And so that, I think, is his third sort of view. And as I look back at his record, and it's interesting to note that Bob Corker, who's the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's pretty favorable to Trump or has been in the past, said in an interview in Politico recently that authoritarianism, support for authoritarianism abroad, is a real thing with Trump, that he believes that that's a genuine belief that Trump has. And coming from Corker, that's interesting. So when we look at these three beliefs, I can't really find anything he said, certainly not in a sustained way, that criticizes any of those views. I mean, as far as I can tell, he's been very consistent in all of those things. And it adds up to sort of an overarching worldview, which is the United States is in decline or in trouble because other countries are exploiting it, particularly its sort of friends and allies. And he sort of has a perfect fusion of domestic and foreign policy, right? Because he sees them as one and the same. His domestic policy is we're in trouble because other countries are doing bad things to us. And so most foreign policy people find it hard to relate the two, but he doesn't. And it's quite a negative message. So I think that that doesn't cover everything. And certainly his views evolved over time on the Middle East after 9/11 and 2000s. He began to focus on that. Mexican immigration, obviously a very big part of his campaign, came a lot later. He stopped sort of complaining about Japan as much after the great stagnation there and began to focus on China. So it does change a bit. But I do think that there is some consistency to it. The other thing we know about Trump is that he views everything personally. He sort of sees everything through a personal lens. And he often judges countries in terms of how he gets on with their leaders, or if he thinks they slighted him in some way, or if they said nice things about him. He sort of likes Putin in part because he said nice things about him. And just as an aside, and it's not totally related, but I do think it's sort of funny, is, you know, it's an interesting question to say, well, when did he decide to run for president? You know, because he thought about running for president in 1987, 88. And he thought about running as a reform candidate, an independent candidate in 2000. So why did he run in 2016? Well, you know, everyone knows he had a problem with President Obama over the birther thing. He was very anti-Obama. But what people, not as many people know, is that he wasn't always a birther. In 2009, he was actually relatively favorable to Obama. And there's a story that David Axelrod, Obama's chief campaign manager or campaign strategist, tells, which I think is a little bit relevant in terms of how Trump views everything personally. Donald Trump approached the Obama administration and offered help twice in 2010. And on both occasions, he never got a call back. And he took that sort of personally. And the first thing was the BP oil spill. Remember the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico? Well, Trump called up and offered to run the operation to rescue the Gulf of Mexico, but he didn't have any background in it. So Axelrod said, I'll run it up the flagpole and we'll see. And he never got back to him. So Trump is not too happy about that. But then he called up again and he said, you know, I just saw you had this recent state dinner with China and it was held in a tent. It was in a marquee tent. So that was terrible. He said, I will build you a brand new ballroom for $100 million and it'll be beautiful. And you'll never have to worry about that again. And Axelrod sort of laughed, but said he'd get back to him and never did. And in 2013, at the CPAC conference, that big conservative conference, Trump said, I want to tell you a story. He said, a couple of years ago, I saw a major, major state dinner, and it was in a tent on the White House lawn, a bad tent, probably a tent that the guy who owns the tent made a fortune, probably rented it for one night for more than it cost him. And I said to myself, you know, here's China in a tent. And I called up the White House, someone I know very well, very high position, and said, I will free of charge offer to build the most beautiful ballroom here in the country anywhere. I'll do it. It will cost you only $50 to $100 million. And they said, thank you very much. What an offer. We never heard from them. That's the problem with this country. It's a small thing, but that's the problem with this country. You don't hear from people. Right. And so this sort of got to him a little bit. And I think it's important just in the sense that he does tend to view a lot of these things through a personal lens, more so than most presidents do. Trump ran for president, of course, and he won. But in the course of it, he was ignored and ridiculed by many people. But he doubled and tripled down in his beliefs in response. Now, and this is a pretty important point, that the Republican foreign policy establishment was appalled, genuinely appalled at his foreign policy. And the vast majority of them signed letters promising never to support him and never to work for him. And he responded in kind by promising never to hire them if he won. None of them thought he would win, but they were sincere in their opposition because they didn't agree with a pro-Russia policy or an anti-trade policy or anti-alliances policy. So Trump had a real problem. He had no one to help him. And there was a period in January and February when people said, who are your foreign policy advisors? And he had no answer. So he turned to other people, people on the fringes. Michael Flynn, who since resigned as national security advisor, Steve Bannon, the CEO of Breitbart. And they sort of gave him sort of a nationalist frame and an anti-Islam frame for much of what he said. And over the course of the next few months, he would rage against globalism and the foreign policy establishment and the post-war international order. And it wasn't an act, because the extraordinary thing is that he became president, nominee and then president, with this radical message that really was rooted in his own beliefs. And it was a very radical critique of American foreign policy. When you think about it, he was promising the most change to American foreign policy of any candidate since World War II, which is really an extraordinary thing for someone who most people regard as a novice on these things. But he did that completely unprepared to implement any of it, because although these ideas are deeply held, they're very underdeveloped. There's no think tank that he has trying to work out how to turn them into policy. There are no people trying to really figure out what it means in an operational sense. And so he didn't really have anyone to staff his positions. He hadn't really thought through all of the dilemmas, all of the problems that emerge when you're president of the United States. How do you back Assad and Putin in Syria and not empower Iran? He'd never thought about that. So he promised to work with Assad and also to contain Iran, even though those two things are totally contradictory. And so when he came into office, the worldview was part of it, but it was only half of the story. The other half of the story was that he had to appoint mainstream people to all of these other positions. General Mattis, Secretary Tillerson, General Kelly, H.R. McMaster now, who replaced Michael Flynn. And so this administration is deeply divided between two different factions, between the America First faction that Trump is a part of and leads, but it's actually quite tiny. It only consists of a handful of people. And then everyone else who wants to protect America's alliances, protect the open trading system, have sort of a skepticism about Russia, and generally be engaged and sort of leading in the world. And I think the most important thing overall to understand about the Trump administration's foreign policy, that it is not just reflective of the president. He is an important part of it, but it is deeply divided. There's sort of a, what I call a Jekyll and Hyde quality to it. And it's becoming more Jekyll, the good part, rather than the bad part over time. But Hyde is always there in the background in terms of when Trump erupts at something or when he's sort of offended by something. And the big question is how this, it will never resolve itself, but the big question is what's the preeminent force over time? I think there are signs that it's trending toward normality. President Trump is boxed in on Russia. He wanted to lift sanctions, but he couldn't because Congress promised to reintroduce them. And on various other issues, as we'll see in a minute, on alliances, he's moderated his position somewhat. So let me now turn to Asia and what it means for Asia. And I think that backdrop is sort of important in just setting the overall frame, because it's actually, there's so much that we don't know yet about what the Trump administration is going to do in Asia or Europe or anything else, that I think it's important to look at what we do know in terms of the background of some of these people and the background in particular of the president. It's fair to say that over the course of the campaign, Trump did not spend much time talking about America's role in Asia. He He did bash the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's true. And he did criticize China. You know, there's that great video of him saying China about 20,000 times in an angry way. So that did come up pretty regularly. And sometimes he hinted that TPP included China, although, of course, it didn't. But otherwise, he was relatively silent in Asia, preferring to concentrate on radical Islam, on Mexico, on trade, and, of course, on Russia, of which he spoke fairly favorably. But after the campaign, it became pretty clear that Trump and his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, saw China as an existential economic threat to the United States. Bannon had been talking about this for years before Trump came in the scene. He used to say that U.S. support for globalization, still says, has created a middle class in India and China at the expense of the United States. So he saw, Bannon saw China's economic rise as sort of a zero-sum thing, whereas most people believe that it's a positive thing. That you need a, most Americans believe you need a strong China to have a healthy global economy, that a strong China presents challenges, but that is ultimately good for the United States. So the big story of sort of the transition on Asia policy was that Trump and Bannon were determined to squeeze China hard, even if it meant starting a trade war with Beijing, and even if it meant costing America some things because they thought that it would cost China more. At the Davos meeting in January 2017, Anthony Scaramucci, a Trump advisor, told the global elite that the United States did not seek a trade war with China, but it was prepared to fight and win one if necessary. Trump began to assemble a team of protectionists. He appointed as his chief sort of trade advisor in the White House Peter Navarro, who was sort of a fringe figure but was famous for producing a documentary called Debt by China, in which a Chinese dagger repeatedly stabs the map of the United States. So that was sort of where he was coming from. He appointed Robert Lighthizer as his, it's still not confirmed, as his designate for the U.S. trade representative. And Lighthizer was a protectionist who comes from the U.S. steel industry. And there was a few others. And Trump began to rattle China's cage in Taiwan, remembering that he said that he wasn't that interested in the One China policy anymore, created a big kerfuffle. And then he indicated that he traded away for a trade deal with China. And this was straight from his book, The Art of the Deal, which was when you're trying to negotiate with someone, you reopen closed issues, you create lots of noise over here, you try to create leverage where there was no leverage before. So they started out really looking at Asia in terms of a China-centric approach, where they saw China as an adversary. But over the last 2 months, that view has been diluted considerably. They backed off the One China gambit when it became clear that China wouldn't cooperate at all with the United States unless they reaffirmed that policy. And they weren't really prepared. They didn't have a strategy to go in a different direction. The administration became divided and is deeply divided today in trade policy, because the protectionists started out in charge, but Gary Cohn, who's a former head of Goldman Sachs, is now the head of the National Economic Council in the White House, and he's a free trader and pushing back. And the press over the weekend and over the last few weeks is full of stories about battles between the protectionists, with Navarro and Bannon and Trump on the one hand, and the free trade people on the other. And the free trade people seem to be winning Trump over in some respects because they're warning of a recession and real problems if they pursue the protectionist approach. So that policy, I think, has changed. And it's interesting, in Europe, the policy in NATO has moderated too with the mainstreamer influences. So there are some signs of improvement. Paradoxically, the hostility to China created an opening for the mainstream elements within the administration and for Japan to dilute Trump's skepticism of alliances. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe really took full advantage of this by going to the United States twice to meet Trump, once during the transition when he was the first leader, foreign leader to meet the then President-elect Trump, and then shortly after Trump was inaugurated as president. And Abe really built a bond and showed that Japan could work with the United States, could do more in the region, was investing in the United States, and was a partner in balancing against China. He emphasized the close strategic ties between the two countries. And if you remember how hostile Trump was to Japan originally, by forming a close personal bond, that was able to mitigate that to some degree. There was also signs of moderation in Korea. During the campaign, Trump infamously said that a nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula would be interesting, but he and there was worry that he was not really taking it seriously. But after the election, his first phone call was to President Park Geun-hye of South Korea. And in that call, he reaffirmed U.S. support for the alliance, which is very unusual because he was so hostile to alliances. And the reason appears to be that he got intelligence briefings, which he did read on this occasion, that emphasized the direct threat that North Korea posed to the United States. And he spoke afterwards that he said President Obama briefed him on many issues, but he said one above all, that he was more dangerous than anything else that he hadn't been aware of as much. And it turns out apparently that that was North Korea. And so there are signs that he has taken sort of the North Korean threat seriously. Then, of course, there was a phone call with your prime minister here. And I think that was clearly unfortunate, but it just seemed to have been patched up to some extent and elicited a robust response from Congress, with both parties overwhelmingly endorsing a resolution to back the US-Australia alliance, sort of showing that it transcended that partnership. And as I mentioned, there's no real sign that Trump has ever really criticized Australia. The other country he hasn't really criticized is Canada, in terms of major sort of US allies. So that, I think, is a positive thing. So there have been some signs of improvement. I do have, though, have a few concerns about the Asia policy going forward. I'll just go through these very briefly. The first is that Trump has sort of a view about foreign policy as deal-making. Everything is about the deal. But U.S. foreign policy isn't really about deal-making. Former Secretary of State for Truman, Dean Acheson, used to call it gardening. He said you needed to plant the seeds and patiently tend to them over time and not tear them up every morning to see how much they grew overnight, right? Well, Trump isn't much of a gardener. He's sort of a deal maker. And I think there's question marks about his long-term commitment to tending the garden. The second is that there is a real personnel problem. They haven't filled a lot of senior appointments. There's diplomatic deficit there that I think we saw in Secretary Tillerson's recent or current trip to Asia. And that's a concern. And the third is that there's still no real strategic vision for the region. It's not clear what their strategy is, and it's not clear what their positive economic agenda is. If they're going to be against TPP, what's their economic agenda for the region? So I think those would be my concerns. And I'd like to close with just a few words about how Asian allies, and particularly Australia, should respond. I think as Australia and others look at what's going on in Washington, they can easily be forgiven for being very perturbed and confused and worried. They'll ask, who speaks for the United States? Should they stand up to a president that many people find anathema to their values? Is the liberal international order over? Should Australia and other countries respond in kind by going it alone and looking out for their own interests instead of pursuing a broader vision of international order? Here in Australia, as I understand it, that's often interpreted to mean distancing Australia from the United States and acquiescing in a region organized on the basis of China's security and economic preferences. I think it's right and proper and normal to have this debate. And it's something that needs to occur in a democracy, particularly at this time. But I think when you and others have this debate, I think it's important to bear in mind a couple of things. One is that foreign policy isn't about specific issues. It's also about the type of world that we want to inhabit. What sort of world do we want to create? And today, I think, and this predates the Trump administration, there are really two worlds on offer. The first world is a version of the world we've had in the past, a liberal international order of some description. The second world is sort of a 19th century world, one organized around spheres of influence, an order in which China's preeminent in East Asia, Russia's preeminent in Eastern Europe, the US dominates the Americas, but everyone sort of tends to their own area, except when they're directly threatened or they can profit from intervention. And all nations pursue their country first version of foreign policy. This choice is already well underway by November 8th, 2016. It's hard to exaggerate how different the world will be, I think, under a 19th century model. That's a world of mercantilism, empires, domination, and conflict. And so to have a 21st century version of that, I think, will be a radical departure. Trump's personal view, I believe, is to have a 19th century model of world politics. He's actually used the term. But he faces fierce opposition in the United States. He faces opposition from within his own party, within his administration, from the Congress, from the Democratic Party. People did not vote for him because of his foreign policy. They voted for him despite his foreign policy. No one voted for him because he was pro-Putin. Right, they voted for him because he was anti-establishment or for some other reason. And so this is now a robust debate going on in the United States, and the US position is in the balance, but I do believe that it will come back. And I think Australia and other countries have a dilemma when they look at this, because paradoxically, by giving up on the United States and the liberal international order now, and by pursuing sort of a more nationalistic policy of one's own, that actually has the effect of advancing Donald Trump's vision of a 19th century world, right? It's actually pushing in that direction. Cutting a deal with Russia or with China or abandoning broader aspirations flouts, you know, our common values and entails a significant cost and risk and is ultimately an endorsement of Trump's position. I think the better alternative here is to work with mainstream forces within the Trump administration, which really do exist, to cooperate with other democracies to try to uphold that liberal international order in the region and beyond, and to buy time for the US to have this debate. And I believe that the US will come back with a liberal internationalist or conservative internationalist policy in a short period of time. The alternative is now on full view. That nationalistic vision is on full view and people can debate it. It's no longer abstract. And I think the costs of it are pretty apparent. And I think there are elements within the US administration that are working to have a more normal, to have a more sort of liberal internationalist policy. So despite my pessimism, I think, on the president's worldview, I do think it is somewhat contained within this administration. I think it will be a challenge for some time. But I think the question before us is really, what type of world do we want? And that's a global debate that's happening, not just in the United States. And with that, I think I've gone a little bit over time, so apologies, but thank you very much, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, thanks very much, Tom, for that surprisingly optimistic, heartwarmingly optimistic conclusion and a very excellent speech. For your insights there. We're going to open to questions now, but I'm going to take the moderator's privilege and ask the first one. I'm going to bring you back to North Korea, which you mentioned towards the end of your address there. One of the notable outcomes of Secretary Tillerson's visit to Asia recently was the comment that he made about US policy towards North Korea. He said that the policy of strategic patience has ended. And President Trump obviously cares a lot about North Korea. President Trump and Nikki Haley have both signalled a stronger approach with China and signalled an intention to ask Beijing to do more on North Korea. But then looking at Secretary Tillerson's visit last week, it didn't seem like he took a particularly tough negotiating position. So where do you think the Trump administration will end up on North Korea, and will they be successful in asking China to do more?
Yeah, no, really great question. And, you know, I think this is, North Korea is one of the issues I think that any administration, if it was a Clinton administration or a Trump administration, would be very focused on, because there was a sense that Obama maybe had not dealt with it as a high profile issue, maybe to the extent that was merited. And that said, look, North Korea policy has been really difficult for a very long time. And the reason why everyone wants to take a tougher stance on it, that's not an unusual view. The problem is that there are all sorts of dilemmas when you do that. So how do you actually make China do something? I mean, if you impose costs in China that change the calculus in a real way, that comes with really destabilizing effects of its own, right? So what would be required to actually have China put serious pressure on North Korea, and then how do you deal with the collapse that may occur? And so I thought that Secretary Tillerson's comments were ill-advised, to be honest, because I understand the impulse to say the old approach has failed. I think everyone agrees that in absolute terms, the old approach has failed. But the question is relative to what, right? Relative to what do you want to do now? And he didn't have a good answer about what that would be, about how what a different strategy would look like. I think by using words like imminent threat or by saying strategic patience, and you know, Obama, I think, has not really described the North Korea policy as strategic patience. That goes back quite a while, and we've moved on from there, that I think it raises the risk of sort of uncertainty and miscalculation that could lead to a crisis. So my view of what they should do is that I think they need to sort of stay the course, but have a ratcheting up of pressure specifically on the ICBM threat, which I think North Korea views as a game changer. And I think the US should say that it will not allow North Korea, or it reserves the right not to allow North Korea to have an ICBM capability that can hit the United States. And that would allow the United States to potentially interfere with tests later down the road in a couple of years when North Korea is close to getting this, and to do other things that may push back against it. But I think it's a very delicate balancing act. And I suspect that we'll see some clarification of Secretary Tillerson's remarks in the coming days and weeks in Washington.
We'll open up now to questions from the floor. We only have one microphone this evening, but I'll ask you to please wait for the microphone and speak clearly into it. First of all, telling us your name and affiliation if you have one. My colleague Sarah has the microphone, so if you could raise your hand and I'll call on you. Yes, down the front here.
You started the question that I was going to ask, except that the point is, given the understaffing and the let's say somewhat arbitrary behaviors we see, if North Korea happens to be a little further ahead and tosses an ICBM within a few hundred miles of the coast of California, which activates anti-missiles, do you think that the response is allowable to be balanced and reasonable?
Well, I do think that North Korea is a little bit, my understanding is that while we don't know for sure, that North Korea is a little further away from that capability than some reports make out. And so I think there is some time there, not a lot of time, but I don't think it's an imminent threat. I'm not sort of an expert in North Korean missile technology, but my understanding from people who are is that it's a little bit more distant. And so I think that provides some time. I do think that if North Korea were to do that, that would fundamentally change the debate in the United States, and that any administration would probably take military action against that capability, because I think it's not acceptable. And I also think it's very destabilizing for the region, because it allows North Korea and Kim Jong-un to believe that they have a fully effective deterrent against American intervention in the peninsula, which will allow them to take aggressive action against South Korea in the mistaken belief that they're protected. And so no U.S. administration, I think, can allow that calculation to take hold, because it will be very destabilizing for everyone. But I think at the same time, obviously, no one wants to start a war on the Korean Peninsula. So I think that's why, you know, this is something I think that people have thought about well before Trump administration, and they actually seem to be behind the curve on it. So I think there are ways, you know, the other part of the answer, I think, is in terms of China. Well, it's hard to change China's calculation. It is possible to tell them that the ICBM capability would be a game changer, and that they have no interest in allowing that either, because their ultimate fear is instability. And the ICBM capability would be destabilizing, because it would potentially change North Korea's ambition. And so I think it's possible to get them on board on that in a way that it's not necessarily to get them on board in a rolling back of the nuclear program. But it's difficult. I mean, it's a very, very difficult problem. And it's one that nobody, I think, is happy with the status quo. But it's a deficit of alternative paths. That's the real challenge.
Is there a question up here?
Thank you. My name is Paul Williams. I'm not representing any particular affiliation. My question is about the South China Sea issue and how you see that playing out during the Trump and Duterte administrations, and particularly the ongoing relationship with the US and the Philippines.
Yeah, we don't know a lot about how the Trump administration thinks about this. Trump really didn't say that much about it in the campaign. Then he started pulling it in mainly as an argument as to why China was a bad economic actor. So he would sort of add it to the mix. But what we do know is that Secretary Mattis, I think, has been pretty active on it and is determined to have sort of an engaged stance. And we do also know, of course, that it's a very difficult problem, that this was a problem that had gathered under the Obama administration that was hard to respond to. My own view of what the response should be is that the United States needs to worry a little bit less about every specific act of land reclamation. I think those are significant and important, but worry more about preventing China their strategic objective, which is control of the South China Sea. And it needs to say to China that we can't roll back every action and that they undertake, in pursuit of that goal, but the United States can ensure that in the aggregate it fails, that it doesn't work, because those islands will be liabilities in a time of conflict rather than an asset, and because there may be actions that can be taken and, you know, anti-access aerial denial strategies, for instance, that would make it difficult for them to sustain their position. I think ultimately this is a cost-benefit thing for China, that it's willing to run the risk because it sees limited costs, but that it won't do so if it sees that ultimately it's a greater risk. And I don't think it actually involves conflict. I think it's much more about diplomacy and positioning and assistance to other countries and working with partners in the region and going just beyond the freedom of navigation exercises. So I think but it requires sustained effort. And I do think that a crucial part of it is making these senior appointments in the Asia-Pacific area, in the State Department, in the Defense Department, and then having sustained diplomatic engagement. And that sounds like a no-brainer, right? That sounds like a cliche thing to say, but actually it's been in deficit so far. And so I hope that changes soon.
My name is Kate Long. I have no affiliation. Following up from what you've just said, and given the fact that China is looking to expand, it is in a very strong position, and that the United States doesn't seem to have a real position about Asia and is sort of dithering, it's this big vacuum of policy. Can you see China using this as an opportunity to move in not just the South China Sea, but move in all sorts of ways into the South Pacific and Asian region?
Really great question. I think I worry more about Russia and that than I do in China, like Russia and Europe, because I think China is assertive and has revisionist ambitions and is pursuing them to some extent, but it's more cautious than Russia. It's a little bit more risk averse. And I think it will try to do some of that, quite possibly in the South China Sea, which I think it may have done anyway, regardless of who had won the election. But I think they also face challenges. I think there will probably be little of it this year with the party conference coming up. I think I would worry more about next year. So I'd worry more about 2018 than the 2017. So we may find out in about 12 months, you know, what that broader regional ambition is. But I do think it will be more sort of targeted and focused and more incremental. I think some people talk about China, you know, replacing the United States or upholding institutions. I think, you know, China and Russia in a lot of ways are very similar to Trump personally. You know, they have a similar view of the world. I mean, they like sort of more mercantilist protectionist policies. They want sort of more nationalistic foreign policies and approaches to international order. They don't care that much about human rights or universal values. So I don't see them being able ultimately to take advantage of this as replacing the US. That's why I would disagree with the very interesting quote you had from Fareed Zakaria, you know, that, I mean, the idea that China would sort of take over the liberal international order, I think, is not really something that the Chinese regime is capable of doing. But they will be able to exploit it in other ways. Just one point on Russia. I do think that although Trump is pretty pro-Russian, I think Putin will turn on Trump soon, because I think he knows that Trump can't really deliver major concessions because of opposition within the United States. And I think that he will test Trump's ambiguity on various alliances and other issues. He would like to take the deal, and Trump would like to give it, I think. But I don't think he's capable of actually implementing it because of the makeup of his government and the disposition of Congress in the country. Just as an aside, I know that's not technically on Asia, but I think it could be important.
Joe Foley, also unaffiliated. My question or comment is about the deal. Do you think that perhaps the man does have an idea of what he wants? I'm thinking of a situation where people came and offered people with houses on a corner block an amazing price for their house, and they accepted. And next thing you know, there's a McDonald's built there. The man buying the land knew that. The vendor never knew. I go to this Vietnam War. The North Vietnamese bought a house The South Vietnamese rented a house for 2 years, and then the North Vietnamese spent all the time arguing about whether they'd sit around a square table or a round table until the last 2 weeks, and the South Vietnamese had to make a deal because they had no more time left. They were just forced into a situation. And do you think Trump's that sort of a... He really does know what he wants, but he's not laying his agenda out because he doesn't want the other side to know?
I find it hard to... I don't think so. I mean, it's possible, but if you look at, I mean, these are sort of, you know, trade is a good example, right? So he said we need really good deals on trade, but, you know, what is, we still are none the wiser about what that looks like. And the rumors coming out of the protectionist camp in the White House are that they want deals that has the U.S. in surplus with every country in the world. I mean, that's impossible. Like that, you know, and various other things that are just outrageous and hard to get. I mean, the fact of the matter is the United States gets a pretty good deal from the global economy already. You know, and the trade deals are pretty good for the United States, including going back to World War II. And so, you know, I don't think he's really written about or he hasn't thought about it that much. And if you look at the people advising him, like Navarro and others, I mean, they're not really taking that seriously in the economics community. So maybe they're actually secret geniuses who have it all worked out. But it's unlikely. And so I think he's starting all these big negotiations or saying he wants to. And I think the question really will be, is he willing to take symbolic victories that have small changes to current deals that he can present as a win, or does he want a radical change? And I don't know the answer, but I think he wants radical change, but he doesn't know what it is. So I think that's the problem, you know, because if he did have a vision, we'd sort of know. And then on the, you know, he's really been saying for 30 years, he's really been saying that American leaders are really bad because they don't know how to negotiate. But he's never actually said what an acceptable thing would be. So alliance is another issue. If you ask him what's a better deal in alliances, he'll say other countries pay the United States billions of dollars a year directly. Well, like, who's going to accept that deal? You know, like, that's, you know, that's not going to work. And so certainly not on the numbers he's saying. And so I'm, you know, I'm skeptical. But we're going to find out because he has to sort of now deliver on all these things. You know, I hope he takes the symbolic victories. There are ways to amend these deals, like NAFTA, and even TPP and others, that will keep them intact, but will get him some ownership of them.
Thank you very much. Very optimistic. That's great.
I'm never accused of that, by the way. I try hard about doing it. People always say, oh, it's just doom and gloom that, you know, that can you not have any good news? I'm glad you took that away.
Well, it's optimistic for Australia, but, so do you see perhaps a role for Australia as you know, working the deals or working the diplomacy in the region, and in which case, you know, we're seen as relatively benign or not a great risk to Trump. Have we got an advantage in that regard?
Great.
And sorry, and very yes, no. Will he see out the full 4 years?
That's not a yes, no answer, but I'll get to it and say, do you want to take the second one?
My name's Peter McDonald. Trump's been very critical of the Iran nuclear deal. Seems like I'm interested to know what you think might happen in that regard with Iran with a reformist government and 80% of the people support the reformist government. Doesn't seem like a good idea to be turning in a sense against the United States at this time.
Great question. So let me take them in order. On the first one, well, on the second one, the yes, no, you know, the crazy thing is that it's only been 8 weeks, right? And it feels like 8 years. And, I was trying to be a little optimistic in that I think, you know, there are mainstream elements and there are, you know, there are different, it could be even worse, right? So, but having said that, it feels totally unsustainable to me and to a lot of people, but nobody knows how it ends, right? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that this sort of Jekyll and Hyde approach can go on for 4 years without something breaking. And I do worry about that. But at the same time, I don't think he's going to be impeached. Like, I don't think that unless he breaks the law which is possible, but unless he breaks the law and it's demonstrated and proven, I don't think he'll be impeached, because the Republican Party does not want to run the risk of alienating their base. And also, if they impeach him just because they don't like him, he could run anyway. You know, he could run against President Pence in a primary and win, and then they'd be in a real pickle. So I think he's, you know, I think we have to suppose he's there for the 4 years, but it's very unusual and it is very unstable. And I think anything could happen. You know, if he did break the law or cross over the line, then there would be action against him, maybe in Congress. On Australia, yeah, I think you're totally right. I think Australia has a really important role to play. I think America's allies need to do more. I don't think that that is not because they owe it to the United States or anything like that, but because we all have a shared stake in the type of world we live in, right? And when the U.S. is sort of when the U.S. leadership is in jeopardy or the U.S. has severe internal problems, I think others need to do what they can because it's in their interest to do so. Because ultimately, Australia, Germany, France, Japan, all those countries and many more benefit from an open, more tolerant, more interdependent international order, much more so than a sort of a nationalistic spheres of influence system. So I do hope that that all countries, including Australia, will do that. And I think Australia has an awful lot to contribute in it, and I think it's already done an enormous amount. So I think just continuing that would be positive. On the final question on Iran, you know, they're trying to figure this out, to be honest. They don't really know. They were very anti-Iran in the campaign, but then they realized that tearing up the deal would allow Iran to pursue nuclear capability, and they wouldn't be able to get sanctions in place because Europe wouldn't go along with them, nor would anyone else. And this is a sign of, you know, I'm pessimistic because I think they don't really have a Middle East strategy, but the sign of optimism is that there was some capacity for learning there, right? Like that they were aware that tearing up the deal, you know, would be a bad thing. And they, you know, when push came to shove, they didn't acknowledge that beforehand, of course. So I think that that's a challenge, but they do have a couple of dilemmas. They have a challenge in Syria, where they haven't quite figured out how to defeat ISIS and not empower Iran in the region. They have the challenge on the deal about how much to push implementation and how much to push back against Iran in the region, and how engaged they want to be. And I think that's a big challenge. You know, I didn't think it was particularly encouraging last week in the meeting with Saudi Arabia when they had a lunch with the Saudis, and the Secretary of State was not there, and, you know, the Secretary of Defense was not there, and it was Steve Bannon and Ryan Priebus and Jared Kushner and Trump and McMaster, who was legitimately there, and Dina Powell, who was just recently appointed as Deputy National Security Advisor, who's a good appointment as well. So I think, you know, there's a lot they're still trying to figure out. The main takeaway, though, I think, is just that this is a team that's very much fighting among itself and working, trying to work this through. And there's a possibility, you know, that it turns out not okay, I would say, but more resembling normality, although it will be pretty fraught. And then there's a possibility that it will go sideways. And I think we all obviously have a big stake in it, I think, in that mainstream approach and some predictability winning out. But thank you very much. This is a real pleasure to be here. And thank you, Louisa, and to Noe, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Tom, and thank you for your excellent speech and your thoughtful responses to our questions. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you also for coming to this Lowy Institute at the NGV event and for your excellent questions. I encourage you to keep an eye out for Tom's new book, All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, which will be published this May, and we look forward to seeing you next time.